Hello and welcome to the fourth interview in the series Dialogue with Jean-Marc Berthoud. My name is Didier Erne and I'm your host. In today's episode, we would like to continue our series on the life of Mr. Berthoud. Last time we looked at his family background, his time in South Africa in a missionary home, and his time as a student at the Sorbonne, where his studies led him to an impasse that would radically change his life from that of a promising academic to a Christian apologist. Monsieur Berthoud, it's good to have you here.
It's a great pleasure to be here.
When we look back at our lives, we often wonder how we became what we are in matters of family, career, and faith. Most of us try to plan our life as much as possible, but what we eventually become may be very different from what we planned. This is especially true in Mr. Berthoud's case. The time period we are going to discuss today is anything but a straight line towards a definite goal or a series of success stories. It is a story of lonely battles, of setbacks, and of well-intentioned projects that were abruptly stopped. Nevertheless, in God's providence, all had its place and meaning. God doesn't call us necessarily to be influential pastors or famous lecturers, but to be faithful witnesses for His truth and for the good of His church in the manner He has appointed. Mr. Berthoud, let's start where we left off in the last episode. While you were at the Sorbonne in the mid of the 60s, you began writing your doctoral dissertation on colonial history, and then switched to a study of the life of artisans in Europe, which made you realize that two cultures have developed through the course of European history. You called them a culture of seeming and a culture of being, that is, a deceptive culture of appearance and a real culture. Why was that so troubling to you?
We decide things in our lives, but God directs them in ways which are completely beyond our understanding. So that is certainly what happened to my life. I was intending to study for a doctorate and to get academic recognition, just as my two brothers have done. But God had other plans for me. Now, I want to say that even though I was not interested in the Christian religion of my parents at the time that we are speaking of, I had also inherited from them a sense of moral righteousness, a sense of moral duty, a sense of responsibility. And what struck me most when I came to discover the extraordinary savagery of the Western intervention in the Congo Basin under the King Leopold between the early 1880s and 1908. When I discovered this, I was absolutely amazed, astounded, because I had never imagined that there could be such evil in the world. And this evil of this first modern genocide, that of the Congolese, which led to probably more than 6 million deaths. We don't have proper statistics for that, but the savagery was generalized because the King Leopold of the Belgians had, as a result of the disagreements between the powers in Berlin, the world powers in Berlin to divide Africa, had been given the wonderful gift of the Congo Basin so that the Western powers could intervene through industrial or commercial companies that had a rule of absolute freedom in their action within their territory. And this absolute freedom caused all these deaths. This was the time of the rubber boom, and the rubber could only be found in regions like the Congo, because the plantations had not yet developed, and every means was used to obtain from these populations that they produced the rubber. But they were living in a kind of economic autarky, and they couldn't understand what it meant to sell for profit. Anyhow, I discovered this extraordinary violence and savagery which caused all these deaths. If anyone is interested in an accurate account of these events, there's a very good book by Adam Hochschild called King Leopold's Ghost. I recommend you read that. Now, it was a time of the end of the 19th century. It was a time of peace in the world. It was the development of the British Empire. There was control over the seaways or over the world by the British Navy. There were no wars between the European powers at that time. It was a kind of great prosperity and a great indulgence in all sorts of lavish enjoyments. And it was at the time also that there was this Leopold's ghost. There was this Congo that was being savagely mauled to the benefit of shareholders in the companies that controlled the different regions of that huge country. This showed me that there were two directions that meant that were together. There was the savagery, and the counterpart, the interface of the savagery, was this brilliant society. And this brilliant society was absolutely artificial. And I had experience in my own family life of what I called a civilization of being, where we could trust one another, where parents were good parents, the children would respect their parents, even though they were, of course, disobedient at times. Where there was a cultural life in the family which was very edifying, humanly speaking. I had this memory, and I had also the impossibility of getting out of my mind the subject of my thesis. And at the same time, I couldn't manage that thesis anymore, because all sorts of questions were raised. Where did this come from? How did a formerly, apparently Christian civilization produce such evil? And I had to revise also my understanding of history. So the work developed, and it developed in such a way as it was impossible to fulfill the demands of a doctorate. So that was the first impasse. The second was that having forsaken the faith of my family, I was abandoned to myself and to my own sensuality and pride. I was in my own eyes, very intelligent. I was very sensitive also. I understood things better than other people, and I became extraordinarily proud, and in fact would despise the common herd. And there is a passage in the first epistle of John that I would like to read, which gives the description, in fact, of what I had to abandon to know the one who is being himself, our God. And it is in 1 John chapter 2, verses 15 to 17. "Love not the world, neither things that are in the world. If any man love the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eyes and the pride of life, is not of the Father, but is of the world. And the world passeth away and the lust thereof, but he that doeth the will of God abideth forever." So I had to pass from what describes my attitude at that time, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. That is, I had accepted the vitalistic religion of the time, and I had to pass from that of he that doeth the will of God. He that doeth the will of God abideth forever. So that is, in fact, the choice that was there between the civilization of being and the civilization of appearance. And the appearance, of course, was court civilization, or we would say today media, television, a world of appearances, that of lying appearances, not of true appearances which express the reality of the inner being, but a kind of mask. That is why the present demand that everyone wear a mask is such an abomination, because we are not to have a mask, so we are to be true to ourselves and true to God. And that is does not involve a mask. Usually a mask is for either those who seduce others or for criminals. So we are forced into that format in order to lead us to conform ourselves to the present civilization, if one can use that word. So I found this very much in my study of the literature that I was using. I was studying the literature, French literature of our time, in particular to understand the difference between writing which expresses being, inner being, truth, and writing which is a kind of facade, a kind of mask, a kind of aesthetic perfection. And I saw there was a tremendous difference between these two different styles. And this helped me, of course, at the time of my conversion.
Can you tell us about the moment where God intervened in the course of your life?
Yes, well, that is that's where he showed himself to be being itself and showed me that I was nothing. I had a very passionate and a very disruptive relationship with a young girl I loved very much. And this was reciprocated. But I discovered later that she was appearance mare in self. She, for 3 years, she hid from me all her friends who shared her Marxist sentiments, her atheistic sentiments, and she pretended to be what she called to be a Catholic Protestant. Anyhow, I found myself there in a tremendous impasse. We had spent a weekend with an old aunt of mine who was a kind of example of what this old civilization where being had the domination over appearance. And at the end of the weekend, I was waiting on for my friend to take the train to where she was living in Orbe, which was the birthplace of Pierre Viret, teaching there, and suddenly something happened to me. I was not expecting anything of the kind. I was not in a state of depression. I was not in any way convinced by my sin, rather the contrary. I was not under any kind of religious influence. And suddenly, I lost all sense of physical and spiritual existence. I would feel my hands, my legs, nothing was there. I could feel nothing. There was no connection with my body. And there was not even an anguish. I was simply, suddenly I realized I was finished. I was, in fact, perhaps appearing to be living, but I was dead. In fact, later on I discovered that God was showing me that against him and without him I was dead in my sins. But I didn't understand, of course, that at all at the time. And my friend turns to me and says, "Where are you?" Echoing the question that God asked Adam, "Where are you?" And of course, I could not answer. I just said, "I don't know what is now happening to me, but I know one thing, that I'm finished. There's nothing." And she felt it very strongly. And the train went away, and I had to go back to my little attic room in Neuchâtel, where I was teaching in the commercial school. Now, of course, there was also an impasse in that direction because I didn't see how I could have a career. Because I didn't come back from 4 years of advanced research with a document, with a diploma, But, of course, even my diplomas that I had earned in South Africa were not recognized. So there was no future for me, even professionally. And it seemed to me that there was no future with me with this girl I loved. So the impasse was in every direction, professionally, physically, spiritually. I turned to... I phoned my brother, who was Christian, and asked him what was happening to me. He couldn't answer. Certainly he prayed, and others prayed. I went up to my room, and I sat down at my little table. And on the table was a book that I had left several days before, opened on the desk. And I looked at it, and I read, "He who in anguish turns to God, God will never abandon him." And of course, this was, I didn't know, a quotation from a psalm, but it wasn't indicated as such. It was Calvin's treatise on scandals, and he was in fact quoting scripture without indicating it. And I asked myself, I don't believe in God. In fact, this makes no sense. God doesn't exist. But then I unconsciously did Pascal's wager. So I said to myself, in the state you are in, if God really exists and you turn to him, you have everything to gain. But if he doesn't exist, you have nothing to lose. You cannot be in a worse state than you are in. So I turned to my bed, knelt as I did when I was a little child, and prayed, and I said to God, I want to be very clear with you. I don't believe in you. In fact, as far as I'm concerned, you don't exist. But I don't know everything. And if you do exist, it is not for me to find you. It is for you to reveal yourself to me. And he did so without any experience, without any anything apparently changing. I had prayed Charles de Foucault's prayer that he prayed for some 10 years every Friday in the same church in Paris, and finally God answered him. I'd prayed that prayer. I had not felt anything. Nothing seemed to have changed, but the whole of my life changed direction. I was, of course, I was in a state that I couldn't teach anymore. I was forced to resign as a school teacher. I, by God's providence, found immediately some work, manual work, in the hospital gardens just next to my lodging. I was working with people who were not expected to give satisfactory economic labor, but they were there just to be occupied, and it was exactly the situation I needed. I stayed for a while there, then came back to Lausanne, and finally engaged in a landscape gardening enterprise as a manual worker, and stayed there for 5 years. And this had a very wonderful therapeutic influence on me, far better than, I think, than any kind of psychological treatment. So that's how I went through this experience, which turned my life altogether upside down. Of course, with regard to this friend, she had quite extraordinary domination over me before. And from that day, this domination disappeared totally. I was free again, free from sin, free from my passions. And this put her in incredible rages. Anyhow, we finally had to separate. We broke the relationship, and I developed... these 5 years as a gardener were certainly amongst the most profitable, the most agreeable years of labor in my life. So that's how God turned reset my life, I can put it that way.
In hindsight, how do you think that the experience of utter nothingness was instrumental to understanding the fundamental problem that we currently have?
Now, this sense of nothingness is quite common amongst modern thinkers and philosophers and poets. For example, T.S. Eliot wrote a book, a poem, a remarkable poem called Descriptive of Our Modern Civilization, called The Hollow Men. And a Jewish philosopher, Swiss philosopher called Max Picard, wrote a book entitled The Man of Nothing. And the man of nothing was, of course, Hitler. And in fact, we could speak of a civilization of nothing. We have turned our backs on God. Even most churches don't take really God seriously, the word seriously. They will cheat with the word to adapt themselves to society. But this world has turned its back on God. It has turned its back on God's law, on God's word, on the order of creation. And when you turn against the God who is being himself, then you become nothing. And the experience I had was that all my pride was nothing. And all the pride of our civilization is also nothing. It's a hollow world. There's a very interesting description of modern physics as the hollow world. Why hollow world? Because there is almost nothing but void in that world. Whether it's in the very small or the very great. What I realized this year 2020, with coronavirus and all the rest, is that it seems as if God suddenly drew the curtain, and everything was seen to be hollow. Nothing could stand. Nothing. Nobody could resist the diktats of all sorts of government worldwide. There was nothing, in fact, to resist, enabling men to resist the extraordinary measures of tyranny that were imposed on everyone. In fact, confining the population of the world, at least a part of it, is like putting everybody into prison, into a house prison. And this produced almost no resistance because there was nobody to resist. And that's how I came to understand that what I had experienced in the middle 60s of the last century was a kind of premonition of what was happening today.
Can you tell us the story how you met your wife Rosemary in the late 60s?
Yes, it's quite simple. At the time, I was very interested in studying the Bible and reading the Bible, and the more I read it, the more I was impressed by its truth. I've never had any problem about the inspiration or the infallibility of the Bible, nor of its truth, nor of its applicability. My experience had been so strong that Scripture became my daily food. And we had organized a little Bible study in my mother's home, where I had been living for a while. I was renting. I had a room in her apartment, and my sister, who was a nurse, met my Rosemary, who was in fact working with a biblical group for nurses, and my sister invited Rosemary to our Bible study. And of course, I was very pleased to meet somebody at last who was peaceful and calm and stable. And it wasn't love at first sight. It was a great pleasure in meeting somebody who had such a character. And later on, we became married, engaged, and married.
In the 70s, your family grew rapidly, and you had to provide for eventually 5 children. What did you do professionally during this period?
So, due to particular circumstances, I was put out of my work by my boss because I had questioned some of his actions, which had been extremely damaging to his employees, in the middle of the winter. But I found another piece of work half time, and also a friend of mine who was working as a railroad porter had to go to military service, and he asked me if I could take on his job, and I was very pleased to take on his job. And after a while, he never came back, and I stayed at the railway station. It was during this time that we got to know one another better with my wife, and we got engaged, we prepared a marriage, and we were married. And so for 10 years, I earned my living from carrying bags as an independent railroad porter, carrying bags in Lausanne Railway Station. And it was an extremely profitable, not so much financially, but humanly and intellectually profitable period. For one thing, I had enormous number of contacts with all sorts of people who were traveling and came to realize that most of what was I was hearing on the radio or in the television or reading in the press was fabricated. It didn't correspond to what was happening from personal witnesses on site. And also I had time to read the Bible, because between trains we had to spend our time as we could. This was 10 years, and after 10 years of this work, which I quite enjoyed, I must say, it was necessary to earn more money. And the main post office in Lausanne was just next to the station, and so I find work in the evening to supplement my gain, my meager gain in the day. I find a part-time job, and later this became full-time, and I stayed at the post office for some 22 years. I had long often wanted to leave this work in order to engage myself in Christian work. I even envisaged studying theology. But this was not at all God's plans for me. His plans for me were that I spend all my professional life with this kind of manual work. This does not prevent me from doing all sorts of activities, as we shall no doubt see on some other occasion. So I managed to... We never had any financial problems, but we rarely had much money. And we managed to bring up our five children, who, thank God, are all engaged in the Christian faith.
Finally, until 1974, you were already engaged in discussions with Christian leaders in the French-speaking part of Switzerland on various topics. Then in that year, you started the review Documentation Chrétienne, or Christian Documentation. What circumstances led you starting this magazine, and what major topics did the magazine address during this period?
Straight away, after our marriage, some 10 months after, we had a little girl called Natasha. And during the time that my wife was expecting the baby, it was quite obvious that this was a human being. It didn't need to be very educated, we didn't need to be very clever to understand that this was a baby, and not simply a kind of growth within the nature of my wife. But at the time, this was the early 70s, there was a tremendous movement worldwide for the liberation of abortion, for the legalization of abortion. And this, of course, affected Switzerland as well. And I couldn't understand in any way that parents would kill their own children this way. And so I decided that something had to be done. So I tried to write to the local newspaper from which an initiative had been launched by two doctors who had an abortion clinic, but had difficulties with the taxpayer, as taxpayers. Financial difficulties, because they had frauded the income tax. So they launched, to protect themselves, they launched an initiative legalizing abortion. Many of their customers came from France at the time. And I wrote a letter to the local newspaper, because I come from that part of Switzerland, Neuchâtel. And the letter was not published. At least it was not published for several months. And then I realized that it was not possible in a democratic nation to raise such an issue. So I thought about it. Where was the problem? And I could see that the problem was not with the politicians, firstly, nor with the judges, but the problems was with the general ideology which excluded God's law and excluded God. And who was the cause for this, firstly? And I realized finally that it was not really the lay people, but the ecclesiastics who were not doing their job. They were not preaching the word of God as it was written. So I started a campaign of writing to individually handwritten letters. I would spend 2 hours a day from my between 2 and 4 o'clock in the afternoon writing these letters, and of course no gain from that. And gradually I wrote to over 200 ecclesiastics, both evangelical, reformed, and Roman Catholic. And this engendered quite a correspondence, but led to no real contact with any ecclesiastic apart from one single Roman Catholic priest. This led me to think, what is the cause of this blindness on the part of the clergy? So I thought, well, if you look at what they have been taught at seminary, one cannot be surprised that they are blind. Either they are taught a kind of pietistic, biblical vision which has no relationship to the real world, or they are taught false doctrines of every kind. So I thought perhaps, and of course I had the idea at the time that if you were like Archimedes and you had a long enough plank, you could raise the world. And I thought perhaps if you, from my position in a very menial kind of work, perhaps I could also do something like that. So I decided to found the review, Documentation Chrétienne, which was sent free of charge to all the clergy I had written to and to many other people, and gradually developed because of gifts. There was no payment involved. And we began tackling different questions, mostly with regard to the secularization of the church and of the society, but also with regard to other issues. For example, we had an ongoing investigation into the nature of the charismatic movement to which we had adhered to some degree. Now, the final issues were related to applying God's law to society.
We have come again to the end of what I hope has been an interesting and encouraging episode. Thank you, Mr. Berthou, for taking time to discuss your life and work with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Dear listener, if you're interested in the writings of Jean-Marc Berthou, and if you read French, you'll find the review Documentation Chrétienne, edited by Mr. Berthou, online for free under calvinism.ch, that is calvinism.ch. Please join us for the next episode, where we will discuss what Mr. Berthou has done from the end of the 70s until the present day. Thank you for listening.